My name's Darren Greenfield, and Timothy Hyde at the back. We're going to co-teach this class, and I'm going to talk a little bit about IPM, which is Integrated Pest Management. But before we jump into that, because our gardens are a cooperative work between us and God, we work together, and God teaches us and he blesses us. So let's see what the Bible says about pests and dealing with pests. In Deuteronomy 28, there's a few verses there, and it says, "Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body, the produce of your ground, and the increase of your herds, the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. But it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. You shall carry much seed out to the field, but gather little in, for the locust shall consume it." So, obedience to the Lord in both the spiritual realm and in the physical realm. The Lord has given us instruction on how to do certain things. We should be observant of his commands. In Amos 4:9, he says, "I blasted you with blight and mildew when your gardens increased, your vineyards, your fig trees, and your olive trees. The locust devoured them, yet you have not returned to me, says the Lord." So when we're dealing with pests, what should we do? We should go to the Lord, right? We should pray to him, and we should say, "Lord, is there anything you're trying to bring to my attention at this time when I'm dealing with these pests?" And let him show you. It might be something that you're not thinking of. In 2 Chronicles 6:28 to 31, it says, "When there is famine in the land, pestilence or blight or mildew, locusts or grasshoppers, when their enemies besiege them in the land of their cities, whatever plague or whatever sickness there is, whatever prayer, whatever supplication is made by anyone or by all your people Israel, when each one knows his own burden and his own grief and spreads out his hands to this temple, then hear from heaven your dwelling place and forgive and give to everyone according to all his ways, whose heart you know, for you alone know the hearts of the sons of men, that they may fear you to walk in your ways as long as they live in the land which you gave to our fathers." Let's read the next one. There's one more. Malachi 3:8 through 12. You're probably familiar with these verses, but this one says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. And try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, so that he will not destroy the fruit of your ground, nor shall the vine fail to bear fruit for you in the field, says the Lord of hosts. And all nations will call you blessed, for you will be a delightful land, says the Lord of hosts." Now, don't underestimate what the Lord will do for you. It's amazing. I remember when I was, I just had a garden outside our home in Michigan, and we had been reading through a book called Over and Over Again. It was testimonies of people who had started tithing and had experienced God working blessings in very difficult situations. One of the stories was about this guy that had a garden, and these woodchucks were coming in and eating his produce, and he realized he hadn't been paying a faithful tithe. I think that's how the story went. He decided to do that. No, I think what it was he decided, you know what, I'm not tithing on my produce of my garden. So he started tithing on his produce, and he went out, and there this stray dog, I believe, or several dogs came and chased away those woodchucks, and he didn't have problems anymore. So I was walking outside with my wife, and we had a little garden there, and there were rabbits that were getting in and eating stuff, and I didn't have a fence around it at that point. And I said to my wife, I wish I had a gun so I could shoot those rabbits. And she was upset with me about that, and I said, well, you know, they're eating our produce. And just as I said that, and we had made a decision after reading that thing that we were going to tithe on the produce of our garden, and right then, when I said that, I wish I had a gun to shoot it, I turn around and there came a fox out of the bushes and chased those rabbits away. So, you know, the Lord, I think, is very interested in working with us, and if we're faithful to him, he can work miracles to chase away the pests. Now, in the great controversy in nature, we're told this, and this is Child Guidance 46. Although the earth was blighted with the curse, nature was still to be man's lesson book. It could not now represent goodness only, for evil was everywhere present, marring earth and sea and air with its defiling touch. Where once was written only the character of God, the knowledge of good, was now written also the character of Satan, the knowledge of evil. From nature, which now revealed the knowledge of good and evil, man was continually to receive warning as to the results of sin. So we find that the natural world is a parallel to the spiritual world, and what we see going on in nature between good and evil is also what's going on in our hearts and our lives, and we can learn lessons from it. So as we deal with these pests, then we can also be reflecting on what's happening spiritually in our lives and learn from it. Last quote here. This is from, I believe it is Bible Commentary 1112. Men were to cooperate with God in restoring the diseased land to health, that it might be a praise and a glory to his name. And as the land they possessed would, if managed with skill and earnestness, produce its treasures, so their hearts, if controlled by God, would reflect his character. In the laws which God gave for the cultivation of the soil, he was giving the people opportunity to overcome their selfishness and become heavenly minded. Canaan would be to them as Eden if they obeyed the word of the Lord. Through them, the Lord designed to teach all the nations of the world how to cultivate the soil so that it would yield healthy fruit free from disease. The earth is the Lord's vineyard and is to be treated according to his plan. Those who cultivated the soil were to realize that they were doing God's service. They were as truly in their lot and place as were the men appointed to minister in the priesthood and in work connected with the tabernacle. When I read that, I was like, wow, this is a holy and high calling, you know, to be growing food and working with God and nature, because it's not just about making a livelihood, it's about our lives being prepared for heaven and others as well. So, integrated pest management. I wish I could expand on that more, but we have a limited time, so we will get into this IPM program. It is an ecosystem-based strategy that focuses on long-term prevention of pests or their damage through a combination of techniques such as biological control, habitat manipulation, modification of cultural practices, and use of resistant varieties. Pesticides are used only after monitoring indicates they are needed according to established guidelines, and treatments are made with the goal of removing only the target organism. Pest control materials are selected and applied in a manner that minimizes risk to human health, beneficial and non-target organisms, and the environment. So it's a very gradual process from doing everything naturally that you can to cooperate with nature to combat the pests, and only if you have a really severe infestation that you resort to a pesticide, and then you want to choose something that targets only the pest and doesn't harm the environment that the plants are growing in or human health. So the very first principle with this is starting with soil health. The class that Whitmar is teaching on soil management or soil health is an excellent class to take. If you obviously you're not in it because you're here, but if you can listen to the class and you can learn the principles, take soil tests, follow the guidelines, apply what is recommended, and get your soil in the healthiest condition, because if your soil is in the healthiest condition it can be, it makes your plants healthy. And just like we have an immune system, plants have an immune system that can combat the pests and disease as well. So you want them to be in the best condition possible, and that starts with soil health. Weed control. Weeds provide habitat for pests. Weeds harbour disease. Weeds drastically reduce the yield. So keep the weeds out of your garden. Work when they're very small. When they're very tiny, it's very easy to just scuff the dirt and get rid of them. But when they get bigger, it becomes four or five times harder to get the weeds out. Don't let them get ahead of you. Jump on them, get them out of there, and you will reduce the amount of work and the problems that you'll have after that. I didn't include a slide here, but Ellen White says that weeds, noxious weeds, were a result of the amalgamation of the devil. He basically took things that God had created, amalgamated them, or GMO practice of some kind, and developed these noxious weeds that are a great pest to us today. You want to eliminate stresses. Watering, if you don't supply adequate water to your plants, you create stress for them. And so you want to eliminate any form of stress if you can. If you're growing cool weather crops in the heat of the summer, then you want to have sprinklers or something that will reduce the temperature down, and so that they don't have the same pressure that they will have trying to grow out of season. I like to grow things in season. I tried growing things out of season, and you spend a lot of time combating the problems that come as a result of it. So I can't go into detail, but as far as like when you're growing tomatoes, that seems to be a common problem where you have blossom end rot. Proper irrigation eliminates that typically. And the picture that I previously had there was a tensiometer. And a tensiometer is a way of measuring and knowing how much water is needed. Tomatoes need a deep watering. If you just are doing a regular watering like you do for any other vegetables, it's a shallow watering that usually affects the top 12 inches. Tomatoes, if the soil conditions are right, will put their roots down 8 feet. And so when they're trying to draw up water and it's dry in the lower zone, then they're not able, the moisture helps the calcium be taken up into the plants, and so that it prevents this blossom end rot. And anyone who's grown tomatoes has had to deal with, I'm sure, with this problem. So I can't get into more detail because of time, but if you do a Google search, tensiometer, there's a irrigation company called Berry Hill Irrigation. They sell them, and it's well worth the money to buy them and put them in. The next principle is provide habitat for beneficial insects and birds and etc. that can work for you in combating pests that will be a problem. One of the things that is promoted with this IPM program is putting in hedgerows, typically native type of plants and flowers, that provide habitat for beneficial insects. And it works. There's things like ladybugs. You're probably familiar with ladybugs. You can even buy them from some of the stores to release, and they'll eat aphids and other things. But if you put in a hedgerow or plants that provide habitat for them, you don't have to go and buy the ladybugs. They come to you because you've provided them with food and habitat. So plant some of these things, flowers and so forth will provide that. And these ladybugs and lacewings and other insects will go and eat the bugs and reduce the pressure. I probably should have said more about reducing the stresses, because really, if you've observed in your garden, the healthy plants are the last ones to get attacked. It's the ones that are a little bit sick, the ones that are stressed, that the bugs go straight for. They target them. And so doing everything you can, and I may not have put much in here about foliar feeding. Has anyone done foliar feeding where you do sprays and feed the leaves? the plants, the stomata on the leaves, open up at night. So in the evening as the sun's going down, they open up and they close up in the morning as the sun comes out. If you'll do a foliar feed of some kind of, kelp, worm casting tea or compost teas and that sort of thing, they absorb the nutrients and they become much more robust and have a better chance at combating pests and diseases. This is a picture of a lacewing. And they will move in and start eating the bugs. This is a bird, I don't know if you have them in your area, but we have bluebirds in California. And these nest boxes, if you put an 1 5/8 hole in the nest box, then only the bluebirds will move into them. And they eat an amazing amount of bugs. When they have their nest in there and they're feeding their young, you can watch them and they're just flying backwards and forwards, continually feeding these little bugs that they've been catching off the plants. And there are other birds that will do that as well. Bat boxes. Bats will eat moths. And moths are often, if you have an orchard, and codling moth and other things, if you put up bat boxes, the bats will go to work for you and eat them, as well as the pesky mosquitoes that bite you when you work in your garden. So bat boxes are really highly recommended, and they will reduce your pressure. Barn owls. If you put up a barn owl box, nest box, or several of them, the barn owls will move in, and they eat a lot of the rodents and the little pests. They, in fact, I've read some of the statistics. They eat an incredible number of them in a season. And so if you're having problems, we have sweet potatoes, and they like, the little voles like to eat into the sweet potatoes. And the only reason we have not put up the barn owl nest boxes is because we live right next to the farm backs right onto railway tracks and a freeway. And the recommendations are, if you're within a mile of the train tracks or a freeway, barn owls fly low, and they fly right in front of traffic or trains and get hit and killed. And so we're not in the best situation. But if we weren't, I would be putting them in. But I'm sharing it with you because you may not be in that situation. So another natural predator is... there's different raptors, and you can put up a pole that they like to perch on, and they will come and sit on top of that pole, and they will look down and see critters in your garden, and they will fly down and eat them. So we did put up some poles, and definitely we would see them there sitting and looking and hunting. I was a bit disappointed. We have gophers, and... there's gopher snakes too, and gopher snakes are good to have. And but one time I saw I don't know if it was a falcon, I think it was a falcon, sitting up on the raptor pole, and all of a sudden it swooped down and took one of the gopher snakes away. So I wasn't too happy about that. But anyway, they will work for you. This book here is a book that the University of California put out and recommend it. It's called Natural Enemies Handbook. And it tells you all the different types of insects and what are good. And so there's basically three types of bugs that you're going to find in your garden. You're going to have beneficial ones that are going to prey on the pests and take care of them. And you've got ones that basically are there. They do no harm and they do no good. They're just there. And then you've got the pest type. So identifying them is really beneficial. And sometimes they're so small you don't know what they are. And you can buy these magnifying lens, these little about an inch diameter magnifying lens. You want probably either a 16 or a 20 times magnification. And when you see something on your leaves, you know, you go and you look at it and let it come into focus, and you can see clearly what it is. And then with a book or online, UC Davis has a really good database on pests that you can help identify. But that's California. It can be very different out here. And I think Tim will probably speak more about identifying your pests and what to do with that. So when it comes to spraying, the spray that we've found to be most effective and do the least amount of harm has been neem oil. And this is just one brand. There's many types of neem oil out there. In fact, the active ingredient in it is called azadirachtin, and azadirachtin is it's a very small percentage of the neem oil, and there is a product out there called Neemix, and that they've basically extracted the azadirachtin out of the neem oil, and it's very expensive. You get a quart, and it costs about $200 for a quart. But it goes a long way. When you're mixing up one of those Solo backpack sprayers, where it holds 4 gallons, you only put about 2 teaspoons of it in there. So it goes a long way. There's if you have a home garden, the Safer brand, they put out neem products that you can use that are a lot less expensive. So this is the Neemix one here. It's produced by Certis. Peaceful Valley Farm Supply sell it, and there's probably other places that you can get it from. So there's 2 other active ingredients in neem oil that are less active than the azadirachtin. There's selenin and melendriol. And this is how it basically works. As an insect growth regulator, basically it works on juvenile hormones. The insect larva feeds when it grows, and it sheds the old skin and starts growing. This particular shedding of old skin is the phenomenon of ecdysis, or molting, is governed by an enzyme, ectosone. When the neem components, especially azadirachtin, enter into the body of the larvae, the activity of ectosone is suppressed and the larva fails to molt. And then it remains in the larval stage and ultimately dies. If the concentration of azadirachtin is not sufficient, the larva manages to enter the pupal stage but dies at this stage. And if the concentration is still less, the adult emerging from the pupa is 100% malformed, absolutely sterile, without any capacity for reproduction. As a feeding deterrent, the most important property of neem is its feeding deterrence. When an insect larva sits on the leaf, the larva is hungry and wants to feed on the leaf. This particular trigger of feeding is given through the maxillary gland. Peristalsis in the alimentary canal is speeded up. The larva feels hungry and it starts feeding on the surface of the leaf. When the leaf is treated with a neem product, because of the presence of azadirachtin, selenin, and melendriol, there is an anti-peristaltic wave in the alimentary canal, and this produces something similar to a vomiting sensation in the insect. Because of the sensation, the insect does not feed on the neem-treated surface. Its ability to swallow is blocked. So if the insect does not get the spray on it, if it flies in after you have sprayed, then there's a repellent effect that comes as a result of that. And so basically, mating as well as sexual communication is disrupted. Larvae and adults of insects are repelled. Adults are sterilized. Larvae and adults are poisoned. So it's quite an effective one. It's very broad spectrum. It works on most insects, and it's not too harmful to your beneficial insects. In other words, when you spray it, it might knock them back a little bit, but it doesn't eliminate them. They come back. And so it works in harmony with the IPM practice. You can spray it with a small hand sprayer. You can spray it with a backpack sprayer if you've got, you know, a larger area. Or you can spray it, you know, with a commercial sprayer like that you see in the picture. But we've found that to be the most effective. There are many different organic, natural pesticide type of sprays out there. Another one that's quite common is Pyganic. It's an extract from the chrysanthemum flowers, and it works. It's not as effective as neem, and it's more expensive to use. So I'm just sharing with you what we've found to be the best and most effective from cost and everything else. The other thing is the neem does have some nutritional benefits, so when you spray it on the leaves, it actually benefits the plant a little bit that way as well. So as a result of these practices, you end up with beautiful crops, and the pests are kept at bay, and you enjoy your garden immensely, and gives you a lot of pleasure. So basically, I've given you a very fast overview of the IPM. Well, this is an only an hour class, and Tim has the next half of it. But are there any questions? I could probably take a minute now just for any questions. Yes, brother. Yes, they do. Yes. Thank you for reminding me. So the question was, do they work on whitefly? And yes, it does work on whitefly. I saw a hand here and then over here. Yes.
Well, first, neem oil. Mm-hmm. Put up a picture. Mm-hmm.
Nico. Yes.
Is that nicotine and
neem? No. It's just purely a brand name. It's an Indian product. The neem tree grows in India, and it's a seed pod that gets pressed for the oil, and it only comes from India. So it's just a brand name. Some American companies have got the neem oil, and then they've branded it, and that's just one that I've used, and there's many out there.
What were you spraying with this?
What crops were we spraying with this? We've used it on primarily... I don't have to do a lot of spraying because of these principles that I've shared with you. But when you're growing in high tunnels, you are in an artificial environment and some pests flourish in that environment. So with our cucumbers, we had a black bean aphid that was giving problems. And so I would do a weekly spray on it as a preventative. So if they start eating, they get, you know, repelled. If you wait until you have an infestation, it's more difficult to deal with. So I just once a week spray seemed to keep them away, and there were no issues with that. In addition, I've used it in the orchard. I've used it on kale and Swiss chard and some of the greens, you know, for aphids. But again, I was growing them out of season in the warmer, you know, part of the year where the pest pressure is really high. Let me just share this with you. If you have to deal with aphids, you probably do. Aphids are all female. They're born pregnant, and for every 5 degrees increase above, I believe it's 75 degrees, they multiply 1,000 times more. So the hotter it is, the greater the multiplication. So when you grow, they love the cool weather crops. So when you're trying to grow them out of season, you're going to really be combating them. Yes, brother, over here.
Two questions.
Yes.
What type of I
don't know in your area, but in California, there's two that that we grow as well as wildflowers. How do you say it? Calendra. We also have Coyote Brush and Toyon that seems to, you know, house them as well as other beneficial insects. But flowers in general. You know, if you plant a few wildflowers, they will help. The question was, what flowers or what bushes would you plant for ladybugs to habitat? Yes. I haven't had trouble with aphid ants. I don't even know what they look like. But I would try the neem on them. But... If they're coming in from outside of the growing area, you could try some diatomaceous earth. I don't like to use diatomaceous earth on the growing area because it's like glass and like razor blades, and it's harmful to beneficial insects as well. So I prefer to leave that outside of the growing area. So if you see them trailing in from outside, that would put it across their path, so they have to go through that, or at the source where they're coming out of the ground or something like that. Yes, one more question and then I have to give the time to Tim. So, yes.
Why would neem oil be primarily bad for destructive insects and not beneficial insects?
It will knock back the beneficial insects, but here's the difference. The question is, why would neem be... why would it... Sorry, restate it so I have it clear in my mind. Sorry? Right, why doesn't it harm the as harmful? It's because of the residual effect. I believe that that the beneficial insects are not eating your plants. They eat the bugs that eat your plants. So they come back more readily because they're not being repelled by eating the plants. Okay, where's Tim? Yeah, thank you.
Okay, the question was about aphid ants. The aphid ants infect the root zone of the plant. They suck juices from the roots, and right around the stem there'll be like a little pile, and you know your plants have been affected with the aphid ants. And they're not on surface. I've used diatomaceous earth around, and it really hasn't helped that much.
Okay, because I have seen that at my parents' place in Michigan, but out in California I have never seen that. But we do have non-native Argentine ants there, and they are very symbiotic with the aphids. And it's a big issue for us because they have a massive network that they all within different colonies of ants work together. And so unlike some ant colonies that are native, or I should say ant species that are native to North America, there will be some competition between the different ants. These ones like act like a super colony. And they bring in the aphids as soon as they find a potential host plant. And also about white flies, I heard someone ask a question about those. And there's there are some beneficial insects that you can use that specifically target white flies. Incarcia formosa is a very small parasitic wasp that lays its egg on the pupa of the white fly, and it'll prevent it from maturing, and that that parasitic wasp will grow inside of the developing white fly and kill it and then hatch into another wasp. And the benefit of a beneficial insect like that, unlike a ladybug, is that in order for it to complete its life cycle, it has to parasitize a whitefly pupa. So those are a very beneficial natural pest control option. So as we are striving to restore the waste places on a planet that is waxing old like a garment, challenges with pests and disease will be almost inevitable, especially in the early developmental stages. Another factor is the development of the experience of the grower. As you're learning how to combat pests, you're going to make mistakes, but you can learn from those mistakes. I do not claim to be an expert in this whatsoever, but I can share with you some things that I've learned. And the bulk of my experience has been using beneficial insects to control the pests. As Darren was mentioning, the pest populations can get out of hand very quickly. With aphids, they have an extremely fast reproductive rate. He mentioned how their reproductive rate is about 1.5 live young per day, and the females are born pregnant. So you can see how that could get out of hand pretty fast. In just a matter of a month, the numbers just skyrocket. And if you're noticing it in like the 1 to 9 day time frame, you can do something about it right then and there, and you should be able to get it under control. If you're noticing the problem when you're close to the 25 day mark, you can see that it's going to be a little bit more severe if you don't get on it right then. Biological pest control is a bioeffector method of controlling pests using other living organisms. It relies on predation, parasitism, herbivory, and other natural mechanisms, but typically involves an active human management role. And it's often referred to as IPM. It's a fundamental component of sustainable pest control, and it works with nature and the checks and balances that God created. And it dramatically reduces the need for more invasive controls when properly managed. So here are some beneficial organisms that are specialists, meaning that they target specific pest species. This is Aphidelides aphidomyza, and the larva will feed on small soft-bodied insects, especially aphids. You can see it says up to 70 species of aphid. This parasitic wasp, Aphidius colomani, is like the Incarcia that I mentioned for whitefly in that it only the only way it can complete its life cycle is by parasitizing an aphid. These metallic-looking aphids are actually mummified aphids that are going to hatch into more wasps. When using beneficial insects, it is extremely important to release them as soon as the pest is detected. Once the pest population gets out of hand, it'll take much longer to achieve control with beneficials. If you have that, you know, 30-day mark of that aphid pest pressure, it's going to take a while for the beneficials to catch up.
The parasitic wasps, do they sting or are they too small?
They're non-stinging. Yeah, those ones are about 4 millimeters, 5 millimeters long, and they're not a threat to humans, fortunately. Yeah, most of the time people use those in a greenhouse because they're somewhat contained. As long as you have good habitat for them, they should stick around for a while. But you can never know for sure. And once you have, I would say, some aphidias, the aphid parasite present, they should stick around in that area as long as you have some aphids around. But if there's nothing left for them to feed on, they will die out. And her question was, will those bugs stay if you release them? And it's really up to the bug. We can't really control that. Exactly. They stay where there's food. And when I was at Sunny's Zona Family Farms, I worked with an entomologist on a monthly basis, and she taught me about using banker plants. And a banker plant is when you take a crop that you're not going to harvest. So you might grow wheat in a pot, like you would wheatgrass, and you infect it with a monocot aphid that will grow on that wheat. And it's not going to spread to your dicot plants like tomatoes or lettuce. And by providing that crop of wheat for those aphids, you'll always have something for those aphids to go to, and the aphidias will follow along and parasitize them, and you'll always have a continual habitat for them. And the beneficiary hedgerows, those also provide habitat for the beneficials. So in order to detect your problem early, you need to be out in your crop looking for the problems before they get out of hand. So scouting is systematically walking through a greenhouse or field on a regular basis. You're examining the plants to determine the pest pressure, the population of the pest, as well as diseases and other issues. So here's our enemy, the white fly. Has anyone had any issues with this pest? Especially in the more temperate and tropical parts of the country. They can become a real issue with many crops. And as you can see here, they can basically become like a, almost like a mold. It looks like there's just a film of white over some of the plants. They can be very tricky to spray with like soap and things like that because they're usually on the underside of the leaf. And so to control them by spraying can be quite challenging. But fortunately, there is a beneficial insect that will parasitize them, and that's the one I was mentioning, Encarsia formosa. This little guy is 1 millimeter long, and he just goes around as soon as he hatches and finds a white fly to parasitize. Encarsia formosa. There are other subspecies, but that's the one I've worked with the most.
How much do they cost?
I do not know exactly how much they cost, but I have a link to a website where you can find out more information. I think you can get little sachets that have the parasitized white fly, and then they hatch once you release them. And I think you can get it for less than $30 for a small package. So all of those black dots are parasitized white fly larvae. Here's the life cycle of the wasp. Another small pest is the tomato russet mite. You might notice on your tomato plants a browning color starting at the base of the plant, gradually moving up, sometimes desiccating the leaves, causing the fruit to be very ugly and tough. Another challenge with this pest is that you really can't see it. And that's what it looks like if you were to get a close look. That's a slightly different species of mite, but just to give you an idea of what it would be like. Darren mentioned using a scope or a small lens to magnify the pest. And I've used these ones for scouting and identifying the pests many times. They work really well. You can adjust the focus, and they work great for identifying if you have russet mite. All you have to do is take a small piece of electrical tape, put it on the stem where you think you may have some russet mite, and then put that on the end of the scope, and you can take a look. And if you see movement on the little mites, then you know that they're alive and they're still an issue. The thing is, if you have the browning, it does not necessarily mean that there are mites there, because it will remain even if the pests are dead. So it's best to take a look to see if you actually have it. So this is a company that provides many different beneficial organisms for sale, Arbico Organics. We recently, in California, we recently got some of these assassin bugs, and these are such cool bugs. They just devour all sorts of pests. Did everyone get that, if they needed it? Okay. And here are a few contrasting beneficial insects. The one on the left is a familiar one, a praying mantis. And you probably won't even see the one on the right. But on the top picture, in the left corner, near the center of the plant, you can see a caterpillar. Those can be pretty frustrating bugs to have on your vegetables. And while I was picking basil a couple weeks ago, I turned a leaf and I saw this web-like thing with a brown mummified caterpillar. And those little black dots that you can barely see were hundreds of little parasitic wasps that had just killed the caterpillar. And, you know, there's oftentimes beneficial things out there that you can't see, but by not spraying, you're leaving a better environment for them. And it's just fascinating to me that even though there are pests, God has a solution with these beneficial insects. And if you go to that website, Arbico, you can see, you know, tons more information and other beneficial insects. Here's a close-up. So when you've invested hundreds or thousands of dollars in labor, seeds, amendments, infrastructure, you're not going to give up and give in to those pests without a fight. You won't give up even if you lose the fight to the pest or disease. You're going to learn from the challenges, and you'll be better faced. You'll be better prepared to solve those problems before they come the next year. But because you're not going to give up, you're going to fight those pests until, you know, you've exhausted every resource you have. So what are some other ways you can control the pests? We don't want to use chemical sprays like, let's say, 7, a commonly used garden pesticide that's not organic, and it's a known neurotoxin that affects humans as well. So obviously we need to find less destructive and potentially dangerous to the environment and to humans means of controlling the pests. So some preventative controls to emphasize plant health and to follow good sanitization practices. If you're getting tools and supplies from another farmer, there could be unknown pests or diseases coming along with those items. If you're visiting another farm and you're touching the plants, you may not be realizing it, but you could actually be transferring something to your farm. And usually farmers are not thought of as super hygienic. I mean, they usually have dirt under their fingernails and things like that. But to just be a little bit cautious about bringing something to your farm or your garden is a good idea. It's also important to start with quality seeds and transplants. If it looks off, it probably is, and you probably want to avoid those transplants. If they look like they might have a pest, you don't want to risk bringing that to your property. It's really important to keep your seedlings healthy. If you don't, then you're not going to have healthy plants. And another concern is vectors. So not only do you have an issue with the pest itself, the pest can transmit a disease to the plant. So that can be viruses. In Arizona, we had a cucurbit yellow stunting disorder virus that just devastated the cucumber plants, and it was transmitted by white flies. So the white flies were one problem, but if we had that virus, the crop just pretty much failed. So you need to be on top of those pests from when the plants are really small. In California, we have had some issues with virus on our cucurbits and squashes. And if those aphids are on those transplants when they're small, then they could potentially be giving that virus to the plant even before it's in the ground. You can see on the right picture that small green thing underneath the table. That's an ant bait station. And those ants, those Argentine ants, would be up on the tables moving aphids around like you would not believe. You'd have it in a little pocket on the table one day, and in a couple days, there were aphids everywhere on the plants. And we noticed that the ants also liked the honey in the bumblebee hive. So you can see we put a little barrier for them there, but we actually have not found a very successful way of controlling the ants. So the best ways are trying to exclude them and just reduce the amount of pressure they can cause on the plants while they're small. Really? I did not know that. So her comment was that she worked with a lady in Oklahoma who would put out corn during the probably during the day when it's still dry, and then at night, after they had fed on that corn, the corn would expand after they had, you know, gotten some moisture in their system, and it would cause the ants to pop. And she's saying corn grits also work for that. No, the Argentine ant is a very small ant. It does not usually bite. It does not usually bite people. But I don't know if it's even on the East Coast or the eastern half of the U.S. It was recently accidentally introduced into California, and it's been spreading. Some physical controls of pests are row covers. Are you all familiar with row covers? It's a thin protective barrier, lets the light and air through, but excludes the pest. This works especially good for things like kale and broccoli to exclude cabbage moths. Screens and nettings, traps, pheromones and lures, and flaming. What I would recommend with flaming is you might have like a trap crop where you're trying to bring the pest over to a non-productive crop. So we have a small bug called a Bagrata bug in California that completely decimates members of the kale family. So we're growing alyssum, the flower, and they really like that too. And so then we can just flame it and kill the pest in this trap crop. Some cultural controls, crop rotation and cover cropping. It breaks up the predictability of always having a food source for the pest. I mentioned the trap crops providing beneficial insect habitat. Proper plant spacing is really important. If you have the plants really close together, it's just like an endless highway of food for them, and there's nothing to prevent them from moving from plant to plant. Some interplanting can be beneficial. It can be also logistically complicated. So I personally do not do much of it, but if you have the option of doing long rows instead of a whole bunch of short rows, then you might have some ways of breaking up the the similar types of crops that are all attractive to the same pest. Timing the plantings appropriately will help to give the plant its best bet of growing by putting it in the season that it grows best in. And here's an example of a trap crop. In California, we have this bug called Liguus bug, and I believe it's also called the tarnished plant bug. Do you know if that's the case? Okay. They cause that very ugly marking and cat face damage to the strawberries, and it really makes them almost unsellable, and it kind of ruins the texture as well. And in the middle of this row here, you can see the alfalfa that's been planted, and that's because this Liguus bug is very attracted to alfalfa. So by growing a crop that they like more than your food crop, you can isolate them from the strawberries in this example. And that's another beneficial that I'm not too familiar with. So when you do have to use insecticides, do not go to Home Depot and grab this. This is not a paid promotion. It is a known neurotoxin. It's not. It's usually a good bet to look for stuff that does say OMRI listed. Those items would be approved for organic use. OMRI listed, O-M-R-I. Is that the Organic Materials Review Institute or something like that? Yeah. So here are some examples of approved and biologically sound pesticides. You can use insecticidal soap. There's Safer, there's Impede. I've heard of even just using Dr. Bronner's soap. Neem products, which include azadirachtin, Neemix. Pyganic, it's derived from chrysanthemums. And repellents, there's some of that in neem oil, but also things like garlic oil, clove oil. It just makes the plant undesirable by adding that to the leaf surface. Plant-based, go ahead.
Have you ever heard of using mothballs?
For deterring?
Around the garden perimeter?
I haven't heard of that, no.
I've done it, and it makes it very unpleasant to be in your garden.
The question was, have you ever used mothballs around your garden? And Darren commented that it makes it very unpleasant to be in your garden. Plant-based oils would be used as a surfactant to spray on the stem in particular of a plant. That will combat things like spider mites and tomato russet mite. It just suffocates them. It kind of sounds like warfare of some sort at times when you're controlling the pests. There are beneficial fungal inoculants. You can get Root Shield. It's a beneficial fungus that assists the roots of the plant in warding off harmful fungus. There are beneficial bacteria like spinosad and BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. BT is often used for cabbage loopers and other caterpillars. If you got the Johnny's catalog, check out this page that gives a lot of information about organic and other recommended ways of controlling pests. In this picture on the right, you can see there's a small brown mark on the stem of the tomato plant. And that damage is caused by a bug called Ingitatus modestus. And I'm going to step from the mic for a second, but that's the bug right there. It kind of looks like an aphid, and it pierces into the stem of the tomato plant. And while you're working with the tomato plant, if you touch an area that's been damaged by that bug, the top just snaps right off. So, you know, what do you do when you find this bug that you've never heard of and you've never seen before? And I have been able to find this resource online. I believe it's bugguide.com. Just search bug guide and you should be able to find it. But it'll have a lot of information as to identifying all sorts of insects. And then this one from Cornell University is, I believe this one is just tomato disease identification, but it can be a helpful resource if you don't know what you're dealing with, and it can give some suggestions as to what may be going on with your plant.
What
side is that? If you just search the Vegetable MD online, you should be able to find it. And it's from Cornell University. I don't have the link right here, though. And here are two other links that I found really interesting, if you would like to check them out. The top one is a whole bunch of information about pesticides, and it explains conventional and organic-type pesticides and insecticides. Okay. Grasshoppers, what to do about them. From my understanding with grasshoppers, often by rototilling the growing area and the surrounding area before the grasshopper season starts can disrupt the nymphs in the soil. We had those in Arizona, and they got huge. Like, there was, you know, grasshoppers like this big.
They eat everything. Every day, everything.
Yeah. I have never sprayed them. I know there we would often just kind of give like an extra buffer, and we just knew that they were going to eat some of that. But I mean, when you have a 100-foot row, that's different than a home garden where you can't really provide as much of that.
Yeah,
I have heard of people using guineas and chickens. Is that what you're going to say?
Yeah,
I believe Alan Seiler has guineas specifically for that purpose. And I would also try insect netting or agarbon as like a protective cover. I have seen grasshoppers chew through netting, so if they're really desperate, they may just go for it. But a lot of what you do with organic pest control is sometimes just trying to make your plants look less desirable to them, or, you know, restrict their access to it. Yes. I do not have a lot of experience with squash bugs. However, I know that insecticidal soaps are often effective at controlling them. You can also get beneficial nematodes that will parasitize the larva in the soil. Do you have any experience with? Okay. So the question was, what about squash bugs? And Darren has heard a recommendation of using bitter melons. I've also heard that they're very attracted to the Blue Hubbard squash. So that's worth a shot to see if they will, you know, go for some of your, like, I don't know how many people like bitter melons, but it's like an acquired taste. But if they like it better, then give it to them. And then you can also concentrate your spraying and your control in that area because they're more likely to be there. Are those the brown marmorated stink bug? Those are a nasty pest. You know, I don't have much experience with those. I'm sure like a lot of farmers and probably all of the California, ag departments are trying to figure out ways to control them, but those are pretty difficult pests. Does anyone have any experience with brown marmorated stink bugs? Yeah. And Mexican bean beetles. So they're a seasonal pest. They don't last the whole season. Okay, yeah, multiple times in a season. I mean, maybe in the north they have, you know, one life cycle per season. I don't know too much about them, but definitely giving it a shot with an early planting, maybe trying some different varieties to see if they go for one first. And you could also use the agarbon as a soil warmer, and it just kind of keeps those plants a little bit warmer at night, and so you could get the green beans in a couple weeks early maybe. Any other questions or comments? And a lot of it is learning as you go, and you know, going to farmers in your area and, you know, really developing relationships with people who have more experience, because I've learned that I feel like my crop is a reflection of my experience and my character. And so as I'm developing these, I want to, you know, find the solution so that I can improve each year and each season. Any other questions? All right, let's close with a word of prayer. Father in heaven, thank you that you provide the garden and nature as a source of so many object lessons and truths of what you want to teach us for our own spiritual lives. And thank you that in spite of sin, you have many solutions, and most importantly, the solution of a new world and redemption from this sin-corrupted planet. And we thank you for that. And as we return to our gardens, whether that's next week or next spring, I pray that you will help us to implement effective controls so that we can really be a testimony to those around us of your goodness. And I pray that you would rebuke the devourer for your sake. Amen.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.